This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. What would ancient Chinese, Greek, or Roman philosophers say if they were set down in the middle of Afghanistan or the Middle East today? Global leaders talk about the new modern world, but how different are today's crises? This hour, a look at today's geopolitics informed by the ancients. Author Robert Kaplan says it's time to go pagan. But first, U.S. airstrikes intensify near the Afghan-Pakistan border. Earlier, I asked Major Charles Heyman, editor of Jane's World Army, about the latest developments and reasons behind the ongoing stream of bombing.
First of all, let's look at Afghanistan. And there is no doubt that the campaign so far in Afghanistan has been a success in that the Al-Qaeda network has been demolished and the Taliban's military capability has been totally destroyed. And the air campaign and the ground campaign so far has been very successful. But this is part of a much larger whole.
We had a sense at the end of the year, Charles Heyman, that really we'd broken the back of the military challenge and that we were moving on to a new phase. But the strikes go on. We hear more reports of troops being deployed here and there. What is this new phase we're moving into?
The new phase is, some would call it a tidying up phase, but it's the phase on the ground. You can't control events unless you've got troops on the ground. And there is quite a considerable number of Taliban and some Al-Qaeda fighters still at loose in Afghanistan. And if this campaign is going to be finished in Afghanistan, those guys have got to be rounded up. And that could take some considerable time. It may take the most of the winter, and it may take well into the spring. And it will need lots and lots of soldiers on the ground to actually do that. You can't control events on the ground unless you have soldiers on the ground.
Are we talking primarily about U.S. soldiers in this instance?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think that the U.S. soldiers now are doing the war fighting, especially in southern Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban survive to some extent. And then there's a coalition of allies who are in the north and are trying now to impose some sort of stability and provide security assistance in the northern areas that were liberated, really, by the Northern Alliance and the coalition air power. So you've got really two parts of this thing running in parallel at the same time, but both very important, and both will take some time to achieve their aim.
A couple of locales have come up in the news. One, the Pakistani border town of Miram Shah, a suspected terrorist training camp, was bombed there by the U.S. back in 98, and there's focus there again. Also, Helmand province, west of Kandahar province.
Again, when we hear these things coming up in the news, I mean, we all immediately think of a pinprick, a small point on the ground. In fact, we're talking about very, very large areas of real estate here and hunting people around those areas of real estate. And it's a long and difficult process. And it is too much to expect the security forces on the ground to wrap this thing up in a week or 2 weeks. It takes time, and it's going to take a long time.
So give us some yardstick of where we stand then in the military campaign, Charles Heyman.
If we look at this in the context of the campaign against terrorism and the global campaign against terrorism, and we draw a parallel, say, from the Second World War, which lasted really from September 1939 all the way through to August, September 1945. Mm-hmm. We're really at December 1939 here, January 1940.
Just a couple of months in.
We're at the very early stages. We're a couple of months in. And we've all got to be prepared, I'm afraid, for a very, very long haul.
Wow, that paints a big picture. Can this be shortened somehow? What about the interrogations of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda members that are going on now? Do you expect they'll be fruitful in a way that might help speed things along?
They're going to help enormously. There is no doubt about that. And they will provide a great deal of good, hard background information, some of it which the intelligence and the security services will be able to act on. But it's not going to provide everything you need because, basically, this is an organization, the Al-Qaeda organization, that's fragmented. It doesn't have a conventional command and control hierarchy in the same way as we would expect in the West. And we're using a Western industrial mindset to look at this thing. This is a very fragmented organization. It communicates in a totally different way. It doesn't now talk on mobile phones or through emails. It's all done very, very secretly, covertly, and very, very difficult to penetrate. So the information that the guys who have been captured will give, of course, is by and large historical information. Mm-hmm. It's not going to give you information about what's happening at this very moment, and almost certainly it's going to give you very little about what's going to happen in the future.
Speaking of this moment, what about Osama bin Laden? Any sense of his whereabouts or whether he still has an active role in guiding al-Qaeda?
It's almost certain that a guy who is on the run and under pressure is not going to be able to have a really effective role in guiding al-Qaeda. I mean, the fact that he survives gives them a lot of hope and a lot of encouragement. But again, al-Qaeda may well be operating on a cell basis with various cells throughout the world on their own individual projects. And it may well be that bin Laden doesn't or never really has controlled those projects. And that's why it's been so terribly difficult to get warning of attacks like the September attack mm-hmm. in New York. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, right next door we have this strange tension between India and Pakistan. On the one hand, we're told things are cooling off. On the other hand, the wires are full of reports of skirmishes, of shell fire being exchanged, of planes coming down. What do you anticipate in that conflict?
It's looking very, very bleak. A lot of people are trying very, very hard to take the steam out of the situation. But it doesn't look like it on the ground. And I've been talking to people in India in the last couple of hours, and one of them, a very respected Indian commentator, has told me that he believes now that there is a momentum in the public consciousness in India that will not go away. And the people on the street are demanding that the Indians do something, and that something will probably be some form of armed attack on Pakistan during the next, certainly during the next couple of weeks or so. Both sides are mobilizing.
Does that mean war?
Both sides are mobilizing. It may not mean an all-out conventional war, but it may mean that there is some very large-scale raid into Pakistani territory. But it's difficult to say. The only thing we can do at the moment, I think, is keep our fingers crossed and hope that our politicians in this side of the world can actually talk the Indians around. But the Indians are very, very angry. And imagine how angry you would be if there was an attack on the White House itself, and how angry we would be here in the UK if there was an attack on the Houses of Parliament.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Army. He spoke to us from Shrewsbury, England. Today's global problems are new problems, world leaders agree. A new kind of war, new tactics, new strategies, new ways of thinking. But Robert Kaplan says there's nothing new here. Modern crises are made of the same stuff as ancient crises. In spite of all our technology, he says, today's world would look pretty familiar to an ancient Greek or Roman or Chinese philosopher. When we think that current crises are unique, he says, we disregard crucial insights held by history. In his new book, Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos, Robert Kaplan calls for American leaders to take a cue from the past. The world is not headed to paradise, he says, and it's dangerous to believe it is. Survival demands an older view, he says, a pagan view of foreign policy. Are you ready to forget Wilsonian idealism and go pagan? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Kaplan is a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He's reported and written from all over the world. Books include Balkan Ghosts, The Arabists, and now Warrior Politics. He joins us this evening from Washington. Thanks for joining us, Robert Kaplan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Jack.
Robert Kaplan, lay out your thesis for us. You say that a century of disastrous utopian hopes has brought us back to imperialism. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, though imperialism is delegitimized in public discourse, it's basically a description of the reality we face around the world. It's incumbent upon us to do something in Afghanistan. It's incumbent upon us to do something between the Israelis and the Palestinians. 200-odd nation states and thousands of NGOs represent a myriad of particularistic interests that don't represent any overriding interest. And that's why what's required is the organizing principle of a benevolent benevolent hegemon to move the world in a more towards a more orderly fashion. In other words, in order to achieve the universalist Wilsonian goals that you alluded to earlier, what I'm saying in this book is it's going to require an older kind of morality and ethic. While democracy may be the end result, the means of achieving it may not be altogether democratic.
So take us into the thesis behind this view. Here you are, Robert Kaplan. You may be the world's best-traveled baby boomer. You've seen it all. You've been in all the hard spots. And at the end of it, you come out with a book that's a very exciting, very challenging book. It's got Henry Kissinger's blurb on the back. This is a kind of not what we expected in 1969.
Well, first of all, let me describe the world and then describe the philosophy to do about it. The world, you know, if you look at the Trojans of the Iliad, they were the envy of the world, urbane and civilized, with buildings and farmlands, believing that their wealth could buy solutions to every world problem. Yet they were besieged by piratical chieftains from across the Aegean, much as we were besieged on September 11th. Another example, in the first century B.C., the Romans, who had been arming this Numidian warlord in North Africa, Jugurtha, this warlord then turned against the Romans, and the Romans had to send an invasion force to hunt him down in the caves of North Africa. So there are a lot of examples from the Asian, from the ancient world to show how things today are not as unique as we may be led to believe. We think our world is so complex, but remember, each of the sides in the Peloponnesian War was an alliance of city-states, of 50 or more city-states, as complex and convoluted as our Cold War alliances. So the ancient world, I think, is a legitimate basis for describing the present. Now, what is ancient? What do I mean by pagan philosophy? Is this an anti-Christian, anti-Jewish argument? Of course it isn't. Jacques Barzun, the noted philosopher at NYU, said that the Western tradition has two components. One is Judeo-Christian, the other is Greek and Roman. This book is about the latter. It's about the latter because it's the latter tradition, the latter morality, that is more applicable to foreign policy.
But Robert Kaplan, I want to just get in there. The former, the Judeo-Christian tradition, was the driving force behind the whole progressive movement in the late 19th century, which has really been set the kind of ideals for all the 20th century. Well, you're saying that is a problem?
Well, I'm saying it's not a problem, and it's achieved great results domestically. What I'm saying is it's not applicable as much beyond our borders for this simple reason, that domestic policy operates under the rule of law, but foreign policy often operates in a lawless realm. And the policy we apply in our daily lives, the morality, excuse me, that we apply in our daily lives, that we apply in our domestic affairs, is closer to a Judeo-Christian ethic. But the morality that suits the way of foreign policy is a pagan ethic, and it's for this reason. It's that when you have responsibility for just your friends, your family, your wider community, that you operate under a different set of norms than when you have responsibility for tens of millions of people, the way an American president does. As Arthur Schlesinger, as George Kennan, and many others have written, it's a sadder, more limited morality, and what they meant was it was a morality that goes all the way back all the way back to Thucydides. And it's a morality that has several components that is definable.
We're going to get back and define it in some depth after the break, but I want to bring Jack Beattie in before we do. Jack, here's Robert Kaplan, and the prescription that he's bringing to what we're told is a brand new kind of war is a very old kind of prescription.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's sort of reading an idea from the facts. This is the way the world works. Force, the necessity of order before freedom, the subordination, really, of ideas to countries' necessities. Nations have acted this way from time immemorial. I think what's different is that our talk about it is different. We talk a different game.
Post 9/11, Jack, or...?
Well, no, just throughout the century. I mean, you know, around the turn of the century, President McKinley talked about Christianizing the Philippines. Of course, the Filipinos had been Catholic for 400 years. And how did he go about that high-minded result? He had a three-year war and killed about 200,000 Filipinos. So we talked very high and mighty, but of course our activity was not that way. President Wilson, you know, for all that he's talked about as a Wilsonian idealist, he intervened all over the hemisphere. So professions versus practices, I think, and I think Bob is saying, hey, let's get our let's stop the hypocrisy gap here or something.
Robert Kaplan says it's time for a new pagan ethos in our foreign policy. What do you think? Has U.S. foreign policy been so focused on ideals that it ignores human nature? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Robert Kaplan. He's author of a new book, Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos. He says it's time to get out of the clutches of ideals in foreign policy and get down and dirty with the ancients, with the philosophers and the strategists of old. What do you think? Are you ready for U.S. foreign policy to go pagan? Is Christianity just a drag on U.S. foreign policy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What about, Robert Kaplan, all the things that seem to fall out of that progressive tradition, about pushing for human rights around the world, about Jimmy Carter, the Peace Corps, the United Nations, peacekeeping, mau-mauing Beijing for better human rights and using trade as a leverage? What about all that?
Okay, first of all, I'm not proposing something new in this book. I think what I'm doing is describing what's always gone on.
Well, wait a minute. I have to say this.
Here.
Yes, but only to say that I've just read it, and you are saying that it's new in the sense you want to move away from the easy assumptions of the 60s, of the 70s, of affluence,
true,
of rarefied idealism. That is, in a way, new right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's new in a sense. Here's the nut of the thesis. It's that our ideals are a product of geographic isolation. It's precisely because we were protected by oceans that we were able to idealize the world and yet withdraw from it whenever we could not implant our ideals.
Mm-hmm.
But as technology has bridged distance, we're in the same situation as European powers were in the 19th century, where they were right up against each other on a crowded continent, and thus they had no room for mistakes or miscalculations.
Mm-hmm.
So it infused a certain pragmatism on their foreign policy. And technology has now put us in the same situation as the 19th century Europeans, that the kind of rarefied idealism you talk about requires a certain amount of geographic protection, which we no longer have. But these ideals are still very relevant. What I'm saying in this book is I don't believe you can achieve the ideals of, say, Immanuel Kant or a Jimmy Carter through Kantian methods or even Jimmy Carter's prescription. In other words, you use the techniques of realist philosophers like Thucydides, Machiavelli, Hobbes in order to get to the world outlined by Kant and Carter, because there is simply no other practical way to do it.
Robert Kaplan, your book is a short course on the classics of statecraft, and you quote compellingly and selectively. Give us a short course right now. You mentioned Thucydides, Machiavelli, Hobbes. What do we need to learn from each?
All right. First of all, Machiavelli's Prince is usually thought of as a cynical book about power. Actually, I think that's wrong. Machiavelli was a popularizer. He popularized Greek and Roman wisdom, and that's why he was called by the historian William Manchester the father of the Renaissance, because without Machiavelli, there couldn't have been a Renaissance. He brought all this thinking back. So to disagree with Machiavelli is almost to disagree with the whole Greek and Roman tradition. Now, The Prince is not a work of cynicism. It's an instructional guide for those who do not accept fatalism, who do not accept determinism, but need all the cunning at their disposal in order to overcome it. From Machiavelli's point of view, he was a progressive who wanted to get away from the self-righteous absolutism of the medieval church, because as Machiavelli saw it, self-interest is the way you shape and improve the world.
And you say that he saw the Christian ethos as too applauding of the meek, too focused on sacrifice.
By being meek, it accepted evil. And the only way to combat evil was to be strong. And he put the emphasis on men rather than on God. So Machiavelli was against all fatalism. Anyone who wants to achieve anything in this world is basically a descendant of Machiavelli in some sort or other. Getting to Thucydides. Thucydides, like Machiavelli, was a political failure. Machiavelli lost power. He was tortured. Thucydides was a general who was in the wrong place at the wrong time and lost the battle and was humiliated. Mm-hmm. What I learned doing this book is it's often political and diplomatic failures who write the greatest books in history, because through failing and being humiliated, they learn all these horrible, tragic things, which they communicate to readers. Basically, I think the two or three most important things to get out of Thucydides is he maintains a tragic sense. He uses the Athenian invasion of Sicily and how it failed to show how the power and influence and affluence of Athens blinded Athenians to the bleak forces of human nature right under the veneer of their, prosperous democratic civilization. The Athenian experience in Sicily was like ours in Vietnam. So these books really are, I think, relevant. Another thing about Thucydides, he says war is not an aberration. Sovereignty doesn't occur in a void. It arises out of differences with others. And then I think the most misunderstood philosopher is Thomas Hobbes, who's always called the gloomy philosopher. Well, he was a genial man. He lived to be 91. He held lively dinner parties. And for his age, he was quite a liberal, because he was the first philosopher who said that the government only exists for the benefit of the governed. Machiavelli never said that, nor did any of the philosophers of Hobbes's time. The government only has a right to govern if it does good by the people.
But Hobbes also had the endless grappling in the dark jungle of forces. It seemed that you could never break through to a better world.
Well, no. What Hobbes did is he investigated more deeply than any other philosopher the roots of our morality and what makes us moral. And in order to get there, he had to go through this dark jungle, as you describe it. He came to the conclusion that what makes men moral is we all fear a violent death at the hands of another man. That's our deepest fear. It's an all-encompassing fear. And in order to alleviate that fear, we make concord. We make a community with each other where we each agree to give up part of our freedom so that there will be a centralizing, controlling force, a policing force of government to protect men from other men so we don't have to be afraid of violent death, so we can get on with our lives and build a community.
Jack Beatty, all morality based in fear, is that where yours comes from, Jack?
Well, I mean, I think if you're talking about sort of the state of nature, then I think he's right. And in a certain sense, that describes international politics. I don't think it describes all morality, though, by no means. Once you assume we're out of the state of nature and in society, then other issues are involved, including what people think about themselves. They're almost aesthetic morality. Am I this kind of person or that kind of person? That sort of thing matters to people, and it also matters to countries. I mean, I think this is very valuable, looking back at these theorists and seeing what they have to offer us today, and I want to read the book. But, you know, one thing they didn't have to deal with much, I guess our founding fathers did some, was the notion of public opinion as an influence on policy. And occasionally in this country, we have had sort of experiments with pagan foreign policy, avowedly ones, if you will, like the ones of Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. And the trouble was it couldn't last. It was attacked on the right for essentially, giving up on changing the human rights situation in the Soviet Union. And it was attacked on the left for similar grounds, and it fell apart. And it was really answered by, on the one hand, Jimmy Carter swinging way over to, emphasize human rights in our allies, and then by Ronald Reagan swinging over the other way to make a new moral crusade against the Soviet Union, and he used human rights as a bludgeon to change changed the Soviet Union. I think the presence of public opinion qualifies the sort of unadulterated adoption of some of these, counsels from the great thinkers.
What about it, Robert Kaplan? Do Americans have the stuff to take their guidance from the thinkers that you cite?
Well, actually, the thinkers do deal with some of the things Jack just mentioned. For instance, Machiavelli would not have considered Augusto Pinochet, who we supported in the early 1970s, the period Jack's referring to, he would not consider him a man of virtue. Machiavelli said that using cruelty to achieve a greater good is okay, as long as it's the minimum amount of cruelty for the greatest amount of good. I think everyone realizes that Pinochet used a far excess amount of cruelty necessary to do what he had to do, so he would not have any virtue in even a pagan sense at all. Also, another thing that the ancient thinkers say is that if we act too ruthlessly all the time, we lose respect from our fellow men, and then we lose our power and influence. So they put limits on these things. They didn't use the word public opinion, obviously. It didn't exist then. But there was a kind of morality that we would be familiar with. For instance, Cicero said it's immoral and wrong to treat a non-Roman any worse than a Roman. That's the kind of statement that lays the basis for an international society.
But so Pinochet we may agree on, but Jack brings up Vietnam, and we all, or many of us, recall the tension and conflict in this country during the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy era. What about that, Robert Kaplan? Was that a sign that we couldn't swallow the bone?
I think Vietnam was, as I said before, like the Athenian invasion of Sicily. The Athenians went in as idealistically as we originally did in Vietnam. Remember, Ho Chi Minh killed 10,000 of his own people before the first U.S. regular forces arrived. But what we underestimated, as the Athenians underestimated, was the brutality we would have to apply to achieve our result and how that would change us as it changed the Athenians. So again, repeat this. There are examples in the things we face and have faced in the 70s are less unique than you've been led to believe.
Mm-hmm. Ndubuisi is on the line joining us. Ndubuisi, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'd like to suggest that as Mr. Kaplan seems to be saying that there was a point in time in history when the United States was disengaged from the world and was uninvolved. I mean, I come from Africa, and I see Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and every corner I turn in Africa, American business is everywhere. And so the American people have a good reason to be involved in the world. And secondly, the notion that there was a time when American foreign policy was driven by idealism is ludicrous. To take my continent alone of Africa, I can point to the United States supplying weapons and money to apartheid regime in South Africa, to various brutal rebel groups in Angola and Mozambique, and supporting brutal dictators like Mobutu, Moi, and Abacha in my own home country, Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So this notion that there should be less idealism, I mean, my experience as an African is that I don't see any idealism. I'd like to see more idealism in U.S. foreign policy.
And NBC, hang on, let's get Robert Kaplan's response. Robert Kaplan, you know this turf. What do you say?
Principles are not self-implementing. Idealistic principles require self-interest in order to enforce, because the minute you put anything on the ground, whether it's troops or it's foreign aid, it requires a risk of some kind in lives and political risk. So you cannot divorce principles from self-interest. The two go together.
But Ndubuisi is saying, hey, how can you say we should be less idealistic and more realistic? He says it's been all sort of brutal realism from his perspective in Africa.
I think it's only when you project your power that your values have any chance to follow whatsoever. Also, the United States cannot be involved everywhere idealistically all the time. The United States, like other great empires and powers throughout history, its primary responsibility is to itself. And that is a hard fact that is impossible to get away from, because you cannot have a foreign policy without a minimum of public support, as Jack alluded to before.
But Robert Kaplan,
and if you overextend yourself idealistically in too many places, you will kind of overextend the appetite of the public at home.
But to get to the heart of Ndubuisi's point, he's saying, hey, I don't see the United States as having done that, though your line seems to be suggesting it has.
No, my line is that the United States has to look after itself first, and only in the context of protecting its own interests can it hope to achieve anything better for other people as a consequence. And that the United States is first responsibility is to itself. That is a fact that is hard to accept, but it happens to be the truth.
And Debisi, do you see the United States as having been uninterested in itself?
I have never seen the United States uninterested in itself, and I wish Mr. Kaplan was a lot more honest, right, as he was a few minutes ago than he was 20 minutes ago when he was suggesting that there's a point in time when the United States was idealistic and this idealism has cost it. Like I said, to use my own country, Nigeria specifically, I can understand that if Mr. Kaplan is saying that the American people must put their interests first, fair enough. But for God's sake, do not lie to the American people. Do not mislead the American people into believing that the United States acts in altruistic ways in the third world, and this has been a cost to the United States government, because it has not. To use Nigeria specifically, the United States government has supplied money and weapons to brutal military regimes. Why? How come most of my Americans I know here at the Harvard Law School don't know this? They think that the United States government is acting in idealistic ways in Africa. They think, well, they don't know that the United States government has supplied weapons and money to dictators and brutal rebel groups. And that's what I'd like people like Mr. Kaplan to make known to their fellow Americans.
We got it. Thanks, Ndubuisi. Robert Kaplan, what about it?
All right, two things. First of all, the United States intervened in Somalia for idealistic reasons, and it overextended itself. And because it suffered a tragedy there, it was one element in why we did not intervene in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, Nigeria now has a democratic regime, and the result of going from military rule to democracy has been a gigantic upsurge in ethnic violence and religious violence as Nigeria piecemeal gradually breaks apart into a Muslim north and a Christian south. So the idea, the notion that automatically military regimes are bad and democratic regimes are good is simply belied by the facts of the past few years.
That takes away a fairly fundamental lighthouse from American foreign policy if we're not out to support democracy, doesn't it?
Well, no, because what we're out to support is more openness and freedom in whatever form it may take. The Pakistani dictator happens to be the most liberalizing force in that country relative to the previous rulers of that country, even though he was not democratically elected.
Well, you go all the way back to Gladstone, the British Prime Minister in 1880, saying Christian decency and human rights would henceforth govern foreign policy, and you say no.
That's right, because what I'm showing is that this, this movement in the, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, where we say now we live in an era of human rights, now we live in an era of a world community, I'm showing that this is not altogether new, nor is it altogether true, that ever since Cicero, politicians have been proclaiming a new era of human rights in the world, and it has not really come about. Gladstone said that now the British public will take responsibility for the human rights of peasants in every hill village in Afghanistan, and a numerous wars followed by World War I, etc. So we think we're in a new age, and what one of the things I'm doing in this book is saying not altogether true.
Jack, anything new under the sun since, let's say, the year 200?
Well, democracy is new, and I think we've talked about that and the kind of constraints that puts on countries. But our caller from Africa, I think, really got to something there. The idea that the United States has been behaving idealistically, there's just no evidence for that. I mean, yes, you can cite a Somalia, but against it, Mobutu, against it, Savimbi, against it, apartheid, against it, Nicaragua, against it. I mean, on and on and on. We have behaved just the way Thucydides has the Athenians behave in the Melian Dialogue, where he says to the little people, "You're small, we're big, and that's tough."
Listeners, are you ready for U.S. foreign policy to go pagan? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. To read the first chapter of Robert Kaplan's excellent book, Warrior Politics, visit our website, wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with author Robert Kaplan about his new book, Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos. Robert Kaplan says Don't get too hung up in ideals. The world is a tough place. It always has been. Listen to the wisdom of the ancients. Listeners, has U.S. foreign policy been so focused on ideals that it's ignored human nature? Does the U.S. have to be bad to be good in foreign policy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Kaplan, your modern hero, if you have one here, is Winston Churchill.
Yes, that's right.
Why so?
Well, it's not the Churchill of World War II. The second chapter of this book is about the young 25-year-old Churchill, who is both a journalist and a soldier in Sudan. In the late 19th century, the British intervened in Sudan to overthrow a fundamentalist warrior, the Mahdi, where there are some, and the way the British hunted down the Mahdist forces and retook the Sudan does have similarities with what we've been doing in Afghanistan.
What can we learn?
We can learn, these were the lessons that Churchill drew, the young Churchill. First of all, that without something to struggle for, your society slips into decadence. Britain at this time was a nation at peace. It ran the world's economy. It was the most prosperous nation on earth. If you had said Britain's power would ever be challenged, you'd be declared an idiot. And so Churchill saw this as a good thing to do, to intervene in the Sudan, because the nation would go decadent if it didn't. It needed something to struggle for. Also, Churchill gave an example of how through self-interest you shape and improve the world. The British incursion in Sudan was self-interestedly motivated because the Italians had been kicked out of Ethiopia, so the European strategic position was weak. The British improved their ability to project power by going into the Sudan, but by doing so, they also gave Sudan afterwards 60 years of excellent civil administration that I saw firsthand starting in the 1980s, where you met Sudanese who looked back nostalgically at that period.
You won't find it now.
Well, the British did good also.
But you won't find that now in Sudan.
No, you won't, but you can't really blame the British for what happens 80 years later. I mean, you know, they for 50 years, you know, standards of living, things were done in Sudan that were altogether good. So that was another lesson of Churchill. Also, another thing that Churchill wrote about was that it's about particular hard-headedness, an ability to establish moral priorities. This gets us back again to the ancient Greeks and Romans. Christian morality is about good versus evil, but the pagan sense of tragedy is good overtaking another good which causes suffering. That in foreign policy, often your choice is not between good and bad, but between some good and another good, and you can't do both. So by choosing one over the other, it causes a certain sort of suffering.
Let's see what our listeners have to say. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I think Mr. Kaplan's argument is basically a very simple one. It's that power works. That is, if I'm bigger and stronger than you, I'll beat you up, and you won't be able to say anything. Or, nothing works so well to convince your opponent of your argument as a knife in the gut. I don't see that this is a terribly sophisticated argument or a new argument.
Do you see it as an effective argument for U.S. foreign policy?
Well, it's effective as long as we're the biggest and strongest.
Robert Kaplan?
Well, it was B-52 bombs that liberated Afghan women. It was daisy cutter bombs. It was the destruction of the Taliban forces in the caves north of Kabul and Bagram that basically liberated Afghan women and sent them back to school. If you cannot project power, your values have no chance to follow.
Mark?
If you project values only, you inherit a vacuum.
What about it, Mark?
It's certainly true that there are places where we've moved powerfully and been successful in rescuing a nation, as, you know, let's say we did so in Afghanistan. But there are certainly places where that same power has been used, as then the examples have been rife throughout this discussion, of where that isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
We have a self-interest in going to Afghanistan. I mean, let's not disguise it. Our interest in Afghanistan was not in liberating Afghani women. Afghani women were suffering for a very long time before we moved in there, and it was only because of Osama bin Laden that we moved in there. So to confuse this, see, he's trying to play both sides of the street. Really, it's
you
the
just
same,
proved my point. Through
line.
Self-interest, you shape and improve the world. We had a self-interest in Afghanistan, and by the way, we did something morally good for half of the Afghan population.
What's the downside there, Mark?
But we would have done it whether our concern wasn't with those people, and we can dress it up and put pretty clothes on it, but that's not really why we were there.
Mark, thanks for your call. But I must say, I don't think Robert Kaplan is dressing it up that much. I mean, You know, the sort of mother's milk of the boomers generation was to be pro-independence, anti-imperialist, and Robert Kaplan's saying the heck with that if necessary, unless I read you incorrectly, Robert Kaplan.
No, and also what happened on September 11th is like a wake-up call for the kinds of tragedies we're likely to face in the future. That as I said earlier, that geography is bridged oceanic distance, and we will continually be put in the situation of the great powers of Europe in the 19th century.
But what this phrase, rarefied idealism, I want to be clear, is yours. You applied it to the 60s generation. You said the 60s bred conformity and rarefied idealism. What was that idealism? What's wrong with it?
Well, what I meant by that was it was an attempt to overcome politics rather than deal with it, because dealing directly with politics means messy compromises, moral and otherwise. And that is just the way politics are all the time. And so I felt that that what the 60s was about was denying this political process and just trying to go around it. You cannot do that.
So by your lights, not ready to be soft on any front, how would you adjudge the war on terror to date?
I think it's as good as one can expect in a messy, imperfect world. I think the situation in capturing bin Laden and Omar is this. It's that you follow up every lead and persistence will eventually bring you some luck. It's like searching for John Dillinger or somebody else. By the 96th tip you follow up, you finally get lucky. And I think that's the situation we're in.
And at the very large stage or view, Robert Kaplan, progress, are you absolutely unwilling to believe in it? Is there really nothing that moves forward?
No. As I said, you know, the end of this book, you know, you remember the penultimate chapter, is that I see the 21st century will see the emergence of not a world government in the singular, but more and more world governance through international institutions, and that the difference in morality between the domestic morality and foreign policy morality, or between pagan morality and Judeo-Christian morality, will be bridged as this global community comes into being. But in order for it to come into being, I recommend the central organizing principle of a hegemon that will have to apply the methods that I describe. So I see a lot of progress in the 21st century.
Is a hegemon different from an imperialist?
No, it's not. As I said earlier, imperialism may be the most benign form of order, because what it really describes is a weak form of central control as opposed to a direct central control.
Robert Kaplan, you're always provocative. We were provoked by your book, and imagine our listeners will be too. It's Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Jack Beatty, Stanley Hoffman told us famously on this show, idealism is the new form of realism. Robert Kaplan seems to be saying something quite different.
Yeah, but again, I think he's describing the world. And one of the tragedies of the 60s is that the 60s outlook, which I think he characterized somewhat too sweepingly, never really got its chance and hasn't really affected policy, but we see it affecting it. I mean, look at college students by protesting Nike's sponsorship of, sweatshops. Mm-hmm. They have affected the behavior of this great corporation, and they have made life better marginally, but importantly, for people in the third world. Now, that's an example of conscience-based solidarity with humanity that has improved things. So these things happen in history, and we have a globalizing economy. We also have a globalizing conscience. And I think he leaves the strength of morality apart from force out of account too much. And I think the example of the students, they don't have any force. They're just boycotting. They're just trying to use the market.
He's not talking about boycotting Nikes. He's talking about the U.S. as a proud hegemon, as an imperialistic power without apology.
Well, I mean, we've never apologized for anything, so I don't think that would change anything.
I guess not. Perhaps not. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Mary Robinson is the High Commissioner for Human Rights for the United Nations. In a speech given last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, she proposed that human rights are inextricable from development, and that if the United States truly wants to remove the threat of terrorism and reduce global unrest, it needs to do more to help the developing world catch up. Here are excerpts of that speech.
If I were to encapsulate in a simple word the goal of my office, and indeed of the entire international system of human rights, it would be the word prevention. If human rights are respected, if basic education, housing, and healthcare are secure, if there's freedom from personal violence and freedom for men and women to earn their living and raise their families, not only are human rights violations prevented, but conflict, terrorism, and war can be prevented also. At a time when the world faces the unpredictable threat of terrorism, regional conflicts in Africa and the Middle East, and tensions in South Asia, alongside the persistence of extreme poverty, which denies fundamental rights to millions of people, we must redouble our efforts to make the culture of human rights not only pervasive, but truly effective throughout the world. I'm often asked, what is the most serious form of human rights violation in the world today? And my reply is consistent: extreme poverty. A new World Bank report estimates that 2 billion people, or one-third of humanity, live in the bleak, hopeless circumstances of extreme poverty. America is a generous nation and is acutely aware that human dignity, human rights, democracy, and development go together. And yet, the United States has a poor record in the percentage of GNP devoted to official development assistance, ODA, with a 1999 level of 0.1%, which was down from 0.2% in 1990. In total dollars, the United States disbursed just over $9 billion, second to Japan, which spent $15.3 billion. Significantly, the cost to each American of this aid is $33, compared to $331, that is the individual cost to every Dane for Denmark's ODA. But in the light of these statistics, the report card must be that the United States can do better. And now, let me conclude by quoting briefly the addresses of two United States presidents made to the General Assembly, one in 1961 and the other in 2001. Speaking at the solemn session to mark the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, President John F. Kennedy urged the improvement of the United Nations machinery for the peaceful settlement of disputes and for extending the rule of international law. Then he went on, "For peace is not solely a matter of military or technical problems. It is primarily a problem of politics and people. And unless man can match his strides in weaponry and technology with equal strides in social and political development, our great strength, like that of the dinosaur, will become incapable of proper control and, like the dinosaur, vanish from the earth." At another solemn session of the General Assembly held last November, President George W. Bush stated, and I quote, "My country is pledged to encouraging development and expanding trade. My country is pledged to investing in education and combating AIDS and other infectious diseases around the world." Following September the 11th, these pledges are even more important. In our struggle against hateful groups that exploit poverty and despair, we must offer an alternative of opportunity and hope. I applaud both statements. It's vital to have this United States engagement to make the alternative a reality for the people around the world who look to the United States for leadership.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson speaking last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. To hear Mary Robinson's speech in its entirety, visit our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is WBUR.